Welcome to a brand new episode of the Cinephiles Live here on the Cinephiles YouTube channel. I am John Rocha, one half of the Cinephiles, joined as always by my other half here, Steve Morris. How are you, Steve, on this Sunday?
I'm just trying to represent my half as well as I possibly can. I mean, that's my job here.
It's both our jobs, that's for sure. Yeah. So we are here live on the show. For those of you maybe new or subscribed to the Cinephiles for the first time or recently, we do this show, a show, we try to do a live show every month. We try to do at least one live show every month if we can. Sometimes the schedules get a little too tight for us to do a live show, but we really try to do one every month that gives a break to Steve, who edits the show a little bit, but also lets us connect with you all a little more in real time as we have an interactive conversation about a certain topic. And last month, Steve, we had the Marvel countdown of the good, middling, great movies, and that got a lot of comments, a lot of back and forth. And I wonder today, as we tackle this subject here, which is our favorite movies that tackle the creative process or the artistic process and what it says about the process and about these movies and about us as a species and as artists, I think it's going to be an interesting conversation to be had as well.
I mean, it started with us, we're doing Whiplash. And is it okay with you if I announce our next film that we're about,
yes,
that we're working on?
Please,
because our next film, which has a strange connection, it wasn't because of this that this became next, but the next film we're doing is The Devil Wears Prada, because the sequel is out in the theaters. And all of a sudden I went, wow, we've got two abusive bosses, young people, both strangely enough named Andy, coming into these environments.
Yeah.
And but they're also both in their way about art. One is the art of jazz music. One is the art of fashion and creating a magazine. And how do you navigate yourself within that? And then we just started talking about other films, and we said, and we had this idea of, well, let's talk about films that talk about art or the process of making art. And man, I don't know about you, but my list got longer and longer. I mean, we could do five episodes discussing some of these movies because they're so interesting. And the fun thing about these live shows, doing them with you, is where the regular show is very structured. I don't know which way this is going to go or what we're going to discuss. It's exciting.
Absolutely. Yeah, I had to cut it at 30 films, my list, because I think if I kept going, it would have been 100. Because there are, deceptively, there are a lot of films about the creative process, whether they're exploring the artist as they make these things, whether they're exploring a group of people as they make these things. One of the films on my list, Topsy Turvy, whether it's a duo that is exploring how they're creating the Mikado there, what that brings up. But also the great ones here give you a window into what the process is like for a human being, not just an artist, but for a human being to tackle this kind of stuff. And I think this is where we find a universality in the great ones, you know, because hardly any of us are geniuses at art to create the things that
speak for yourself.
Sure. Fine. Yes. But the way that we can connect to movies like this is if we find a little bit of commonality or universality in the process of creating art, because all of us have had to create something at some point in our lives. And I think that's what speaks to the great ones, and the ones that are middling, not as strong, it's because they don't really spend a lot of time showing you the process, which would connect you to the character even more, to this famous person you're profiling even more.
I mean, what was funny is I started coming up with my list, and my list, by the way, there are 83 movies on my list. Now, we're not going to talk about all of them. Not all of them are even ones that I love, but once you start putting a list together, it's sometimes hard to stop. And the big thing that struck me is that they kind of fit into different categories, or they have different things in common. Like, what, you know, there's the tortured artist, you know,
right?
And there's also, you know, a whole subgenre that are the biopics of actual real famous people versus fictionalized people. And then the other distinction I found that I thought was really interesting was sometimes it's about professionals learning how to make professional art, or the journey of a professional making professional art. But there are other ones that really aren't about professionals. They're about amateurs, and they're really about the place art can have to enrich a normal life. That this is why art should be important to me, not necessarily that I'm going to be a great artist. And so, like, I started looking at all these in a lot of different ways, and I found that just super interesting.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, too, because we're at a time, Steve, in our society where art is being looked at and questioned and taken apart. Certainly, this week, the big conversation has been about, you know, How do we do the Odyssey without pissing everybody off? And should we do it race correct? Should we do it ethnicity correct? Like, all the stuff that goes on, which you could argue is kind of I'm not gonna say it's 100%, but it can be detrimental to the artist who is trying to express themselves through a canvas like this and what it can lead to. And yesterday or 2 days ago at Cannes, Vin Diesel came out and had a comment because they were celebrating 25 years of Fast and the Furious, and said that basically populist art should not be removed from great art, should not be removed from the classification of great art. And it's an interesting conversation to have because we're very much aware of, as arts funding is being cut, as arts are seen as, you know, indoctrinating people or grooming people. Like, it's a really interesting time right now with artistry. It has to fight to stay alive, fight to be seen. Even people, less people going to the movie theaters. All of this is symptomatic of what's going on with art. So getting back in touch with how important art is through these movies, just revisiting them for this conversation, I think was important for me personally. How did you feel about this process?
I think it was really interesting. And what's funny about the, I hadn't heard that comment from Vin Diesel, you said it was. Mm-hmm. I hadn't heard that comment from him, but I think that represents a lot of what we've tried to do on the Cinephiles. I mean, you and I don't approach Deadpool any differently than we do an independent film like Whiplash.
Yes,
like,
yes.
They're different. The genre is different, but to me, right, it's all serious art. Like, yeah. I think Avengers Endgame is serious art. I think, you know, it's different from, yes, seeing Pulp Fiction or from Do the Right Thing or like, right, all sorts of other films. I mean, I just watched A Clockwork Orange for the first time in about 15 years last night.
Right.
That is art. I don't even know 100%. I don't even know if I like A Clockwork Orange. Every time I watch it, I'm so unhappy and like, but I'm like, well, this is art, you know. I mean, there's I think this is an incredibly important conversation to have. There's the quote from, I think, from Winston Churchill that's something like, you know, we need to cut our funding for the art to pay for the war. And Churchill says something like, then what are we fighting for?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I think there's the fact that when you were in school, I'm assuming there were art classes.
Yes.
There is 100%. Less and less money for art classes. And this is the thing about it is like, because our education system has mostly become about, sorry, this is like going on a tangent, so we won't spend too much time
talking about it.
But because our education system has gone to a, how does this help you get a job? Your education is to help you make money. And I think your education, that's part of what it's supposed to do, but it's also supposed to help you to live a good life. That understanding art is not actually job training for most people. It's about life training. Right. You know, that's the thing, is that it enriches all of our lives, all sorts of different art in all sorts of different ways.
Well, and these are excellent points you bring up, Steve, and I 100% agree with you. And this is why when you look at the world now and the way it's constructed and what we see happening, how people in power, the billionaires, the wealthy, they're wanting to turn all societies into, in essence, a work-focused society, not a let's appreciate being alive, let's appreciate humanity, let's appreciate that we exist in the world existence. They want a work existence. So how do you create people who just do their job, stay at their desk, and make the company owners and the billionaires money? Well, you remove arts funding. You don't let them appreciate nature, appreciate art, appreciate movies, appreciate music, any of that. You turn it into somehow a less masculine thing, push a toxic masculinity narrative, and that undercuts the power of art. And so what you've done is create people who don't necessarily think of art or see art all the time, and so they're lost in just kind of doing what they need to do. This is what they want to do. This is why they cut funding for the arts, because they know the arts are what makes you stand up. The arts are what makes you see that there's a better existence. The art is what makes you rebel against a company owner or a corporation or a billionaire that wants to turn you into an automaton, wants to turn you into Metropolis. And I think this is another element of it all, which is why it's so important to fight for art and for art to be funded and to see what people can create. So when a toxic fandom jumps in and goes, you better not cast this person as this role, without letting an artist show you why they're doing it and what they do with it, I think it's detrimental to the overall existence of art, which will destroy our society. 100%. I think art is a foundational pillar of our society, and profile and talking about these movies, exploring it in these movies, I think proves that point over and over and over again, because so many of us are influenced by movies, by books, by music, by a piece of art that we see on the walls in a museum, like a sculpture, you know, all kinds of things we can be motivated by that are arts related, and they inspire us to do other things. It doesn't mean that they inspire us to be an artist, but they inspire us to create. And you can create a vaccine. You can create a way of helping people solve a problem. You can create a mathematical problem. These are things that allow your mind to think past the box. And art is so important to that, you know?
Great points. I mean, how every single one of us, I mean, I'm assuming that most of the people that are watching right now, you know, obviously care about movies, or they probably aren't watching the cinephiles. I mean,
right, exactly.
And so that I will say confidently that every single person who's listening or watching this right now has had a moment in a movie where they saw themselves. Mm-hmm. They had a moment in the movie where they saw their relationship, where they saw their childhood, where they saw their mother, that something connected to them and felt true, felt honest, felt real. And we've also all had the situation where you looked at a world that was completely unlike your own. And suddenly that world became human. And you gain new understanding and new appreciation, or you looked at the world slightly differently. I mean, I'm not saying that the purpose of art is to change the world necessarily, but I do think that art changes the world. And, it changes the world in the most fundamental way, because art has the power to change us. That's why it's important. I mean, like, and there's, I mean, like, you know, sometimes you just want to laugh, or you want to watch a crazy fight scene, or you want to get scared shitless. Sometimes that's what you want. And that's important too, because you know, it's sort of like, I'm going to go back to that Churchill quote. It's like, if we make everything in the world about how, about your job and how you pay the bills, then what the hell are you paying your bills for?
Yeah. And that's what's going to lead to, that's what's going to lead to depression, mental health issues, suicide rates going up. Art is so important. And I think that's why, and I truly believe this, whenever you see people in power trying to destroy something that is beneficial to humanity, it is because they fear it. And I think that's the thing you're seeing now, is the giant push to destroy art, to you know, to what happened with the Kennedy Center, what's happening with so many programs around the country and around the world and other countries as well. It's this push to destroy art because art scares the establishment, because art can lead to rebellion. Art can lead to you thinking past what you've been handed, what they want you to do. And so it's important to celebrate it at every chance we get, and keep it going at every chance we get, and fight against them trying to cut funding for any of this stuff, because we never know who's going to be inspired by this that will change, as you said so well, Steve, that will change our world, you know, for sure.
Well, and it's also celebrate, and I know we got to start talking about some movies, but but like that, you know, we just had I think it's coming out this coming week, is the short we recorded about the conversation or about the article about Christopher Nolan and the Odyssey.
And
the big thing to me is, like, it is not about necessarily giving you, the audience, exactly what you want. Sometimes it is. Sometimes you do go to a movie and go, yes, I wanted to laugh at a really funny movie. That's what I got. I'm great. But sometimes art is there to be unexpected. I mean, if art were never surprising, and what that means, by the way, and this is me watching Clockwork Orange last night, sometimes you're not going to like it. That's okay. You know, like it's sometimes it's challenging. Sometimes it's not your thing, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't exist.
Because it's supposed to be. And you never know what you find challenging at 20 years old that at 40 years old will all of a sudden open itself up to you, and you're just, you absorb it like crazy. Shakespeare was that way with me. Like, I understood and knew that Shakespeare was important. I didn't understand it until I went to study it in London through Florida State. It was in that moment that Selina Cadell unlocked the world of Shakespeare for me to appreciate it at even deeper levels than I ever appreciated it before. And that's why it's important. And yes, just because you don't like it doesn't mean it shouldn't exist. And just because you don't understand it doesn't mean it shouldn't be there, because someone else does and will appreciate it for that reason. So, yeah.
No, I don't think anyone I know would describe me as a fashionable dresser. For the last 30 years, my primary wardrobe has been comfy shorts, sandals, and a clever t-shirt. But I'm 57 years old, and lately I've been thinking a lot about what grown-up Steve should dress like. Quince has been a godsend in that department. With clothes that fit me perfectly, fabrics that are a joy to wear, and a style that works without me having to overthink it, Quince has everything I need to build a wardrobe. With 100% European linen shorts and shirts from $34, you can find clothes that are not only comfortable, lightweight, breathable, and affordable, but genuinely look good. Even better, everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than what you'd find at similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're getting premium materials without the markup. Refresh your everyday with luxury you'll actually see. Head to quince.com/cinephiles for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/cinephiles for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/cinephiles. Who knows? You might even end up looking as good as me. Our decisions about our health can be pretty haphazard. Maybe you hear about a new supplement online, or a friend tells you about a diet that works for them, or you follow some podcaster's advice on how to maximize your sleep. Maybe these are great ideas, maybe they're not, but none of them are designed for what's specifically going on in your body right now. So stop wasting time, money, and effort on solutions that might not fit. Your body is unique, and True Diagnostic can show you exactly what it needs. True Diagnostic is an at-home health test that measures over 180 biomarkers to give personalized recommendations for your energy, metabolism, and overall health. With True Diagnostic, I get personalized recommendations based on my real data, not trends, not anecdotes, me. It analyzes over 1 million data points to create a simple, actionable plan for my body and my goals. Just a quick finger prick with their home test, and in a few weeks, you could have a personalized plan with actionable steps to improve health, boost energy, and slow aging. No guesswork and no generic advice. Right now, our listeners can get 20% off at TrueDiagnostic.com using code CINEPHILES at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code CINEPHILES for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the combo kit as a one-time purchase or subscription.
All right. Anyway, we have so much to get. It's a good intro. Let's jump into things. I just want to, I put some thumbnails up here. I mean, we've got so many films that have covered art through the years. The Frida Kahlo film, Basquiat there, young Jeffrey Wright, Daniel Day-Lewis there, My Left Foot. You've got Willem Dafoe in the Vincent van Gogh film that he did just a few years ago. You've got Barton Fink, which we've talked about before, you and I as well. So quite a few films that have explored art. Of course, Amadeus, our new white whale that we had someday will do and come back to and do again for sure. Ray was an interesting one from recent years as well. You know, one of my favorite films, Shakespeare in Love, is another film that tackles art and creating, writing a play, how he's inspired by the interactions with Viola to write 12th Night. As I mentioned, the Frida Kahlo film here that really announced Salma Hayek as a legitimate talent to be taken seriously. But you know, Steve, there's also humor. There's some great art being made in This is Spinal Tap, which is a film we talked about and covered as well. So there's a lot of places you can go with so many, and that's just like a little bit of the films that have to tackle the art. So Steve, please take, what films do you want to talk about, films you want to highlight? What are some of the films you want to stress and talk about when it comes to the artistic process?
Well, let's start. My feeling is like, let's start at the biopic, the great artist, the great film about the great artist. And there's no better place to start than what you described as our white whale. I mean, and what you mean by that, Amadeus, I think, is maybe our fourth episode that we did on the Cinephiles.
I think so.
We spent like an hour on it. And I think that was the first good episode of the Cinephiles. Like that to me was where like you and I started to click, and I felt, and I remember we talked after and like, oh, that was kind of cool. Yeah. And we have talked about redoing it forever. And it is not an accurate depiction of the actual Mozart. There's truthiness in there.
Yes.
But it is one of the great, great explorations of what it is to be an artist. And in particular, it isn't the character of Amadeus, who is absolutely astounding and brilliantly played by Tom Hulce and funny and interesting and fascinating. It is the character of Salieri.
Yes.
Salieri, because honestly, as you said, and I joked about it, but like, I'm not Mozart. And, you know, I hope you will not be offended if I say that you're not Mozart.
I'm not Mozart, no.
But you and I have both been Salieri.
Like, yes.
Yeah. Like seeing, being able, I mean, what is the Cinephiles? It is looking at the great art and feeling that we understand it and wanting to understand it and exploring it and deep down knowing, oh, I could never make that, you know?
Right, right. Well, I think that's what's so great about that film, because we see how effortlessly he creates the art, but effortlessly in terms of the talent, not effortlessly in terms of what he endures to create the art, the pressure from his father, the pressure from the emperor, the pressure from his wife, the pressure from Salieri in The Mask. There is so much pressure on him all the time when all he really wants to do, and it's almost a Goodwill Hunting type of situation.
Yeah.
He really just wants to hang out with his people and his friends and drink and have fun and whatever. He can write a symphony like nobody's business, but he doesn't want to feel the pressure of having and then having to pay for stuff. There's all of that. He just wants to live life as freely as he can and write his symphonies when he feels like it, not when he is forced to do it. You know, we see all the emperor as well. We see all of that coursing throughout. But then with the Salieri thing, as you mentioned, Steve, so well, this idea of all of us having glimpsed greatness near us, and if we're being honest with ourselves, had moments of jealousy about it. When you recognize that someone is so skilled at what they're able to do, what is that experience like? And I think that's what's great about the movie. We cheer for Amadeus, we cheer for Mozart, but we uncomfortably find ourselves having a kinship with Salieri, whether we want to admit it or not. You know, and I think that's what makes great art, and it's profiling how great art is being made within the movie itself too.
Two things I'd like to add, and I know we have essentially an infinite number of movies that we could discuss on this, but one of them is that one of the things that Mozart struggles with is that it's so obvious to him that this is what we should do. And then he's fighting against people who won't let him have the ballet, and so they take the music out of that scene, or them saying, or too many notes. He's like, no, these are the right amount. Is that it's the difference between the battle of creating the art and knowing you made something good, and the battle of getting anybody to see the art or approve of the art or understand the art. And the other thing, and I think this goes without saying of almost all the movies I think that we're talking about is if you actually see the art or hear the music or watch the performance, it has to deliver in this kind of a movie.
Yeah.
And in Amadeus, the music 100% delivers.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And it's amazing to experience it. I remember watching it as a young man. I didn't know much about classical music at all. And then watching that kind of open the doors to me exploring it and having fun with it as well. So yeah, and like you said, it takes historical liberties, but it gets pretty much the essence of what the film is trying to say, right? Which I think is fantastic.
The job of the movie is to make a great movie.
Yes.
It is not necessarily to be historically accurate. When we do it on the show, we'll point out like, hey, this isn't accurate.
Sure.
But that's not the point. The point is to be a great movie.
I agree, 100%. What's another one that you want to profile here before I choose one of mine?
Ooh, well, I want to alternate. Why don't we?
Oh, you want to alternate?
Why don't we alternate? Yeah. What's
is that what you want to do? Okay. I would say, you know, Steve and I are big Beatles fans, and I would say the Get Back documentary series I think was an amazing exploration of art, just watching what those four guys created in the studio and what they went through in putting it together, compiling all the stuff that Peter Jackson did. But like, to me, as a Beatles fan, I've seen just about every documentary. Like, that isn't a cheesy 45 minute cobbled together documentary, like legitimate documentaries on the Beatles and profiles and read books and watched all this kind of stuff. And yet I still found myself just absolutely in awe of watching the process of these four men. And you might say, well, it's a documentary, doesn't count. Yes, it does. Absolutely. Because of how that thing is edited to show the artistic process of these four men creating the art that they created there near the end, amidst all the drama, amidst all the tension, but also amidst all the love and the friendship there as well. And what that all took to create. I mean, I am not a musician. So for me, watching the effortless nature with which all four of those guys played their instruments and then gave advice about where to jump in or what to write or what chorus to use or refrain or all this stuff, I just was in awe of it. And I thought this was a really great way to explore how art is being made through the prism of four incredibly talented people that we know. And I thought it was phenomenal. You know,
it's funny. I, as I was putting my list together, I think the Beatles is a whole subcategory because, and I agree 100%. And anyone who like says a documentary doesn't deserve to be in this list, well, it's a good thing you and I are the ones who are making this list.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I rewatched Get Back for the second time about a month ago over a little while.
Yeah, of course.
It is one of the great explorations of how art is made. Yeah. And it and one of the big things, and again, this goes to, you know, what I always think of as the people in the cheap sheets seats who have never made something, is that they don't know what they're doing. These are the greatest geniuses who've ever formed a rock band together. And yet they're figuring it out. And what's so amazing about that documentary, because it says, yeah, we're going to be as long as we want to be, is you just sit with them for a long time watching geniuses figure something out.
Yeah.
And create, and you can, what's so crazy, because I'm just like you, I know the Beatles really well. I've read a bunch of books. Oh, by the way, have you read John and Paul? I think it's A Love Story in Songs. It's recent.
Yeah. Mance suggested that one. I bought it after we had the three of us had the conversation.
Okay.
I bought it.
So good. It's so good. Is that as you're watching them create things and figure it out, and if you know the music well, like, yep, that's it. That's it. As you, if you know the music well, you can hear like, oh, there's a little thread of something. Oh, that's the melody, but that's not the lyric that's going to be in it. And I'm telling you, there, I have never, ever seen a moment like Paul McCartney coming up with Get Back on the bass on the spot.
Yeah.
Is the most, it's the only moment I've ever seen genius happen in real time where you're just, you're just there. So no, this is 100%. Is on the list of great films about art. But I also think, I mean, you and I have both watched a whole bunch of probably lesser films about the Beatles because we're going to watch every Beatles doc. And I there's like Backbeat, there's the John and Paul in New York, like Two of Us, I think it's called.
Yeah, Two of Us, yes.
Like that's what we say is like the Beatles, and I would say Elvis as well, are a whole subgenre unto themselves. You know,
and it doesn't end like there's a John and Yoko new doc that's out on HBO Max that came out in the theaters a few months ago. I just recently watched the Wings documentary, which is an interesting exploration as well of how Paul put the band together and how they created some of the music they created, how Linda weaved her way into it, you know, and I thought it was really good. The last 10-15 minutes kind of loses its way, but overall good documentary. You're right. There's so many to explore, not to mention the two-part George Harrison documentary that Martin Scorsese did for HBO.
Great. Yeah,
if you guys haven't watched that one, that's a massive one to watch about how George creates stuff. Because I agree with you, that moment with Paul coming up with Get Back on the Bass, and then the moment where George is like, oh, I've come up with something, and he's just like giving you the first few lyrics of All Things Must Pass. He is creating one of the most signature songs that he will ever be known for. And he's just like, well, I just thought, you know, let me play this. And then the other Beatles are chiming in. I remember the moment of seeing this in the documentary and just going out of my fucking mind that they have no idea what it's going to become and what it's going to signify. And here they are just coming together to kind of like, you know, play around with it. And it's just, it's just mind blowing. You know what I'm saying? So I think that's a great part of that documentary as well. All right. What's the next one for you, Steve?
Well, I think I'll take it in a very different direction. Mm. This isn't exactly a biopic because it is a fictional character, but it is very biopic adjacent. And that is a movie I love that I would love to do someday. We've talked about it before, which is Bob Fosse's All That Jazz.
Oh, yeah. All That Jazz. Yes.
All That Jazz. And there's so much of your... And this guy is stressed out and fucked up and sleeping around and doing drugs and showing up and making great art. And this is, you know, the thing I said when we were talking about Amadeus is like, if you're going to say this music is great, you have to deliver on great music.
Yeah.
Well, this is Bob Fosse, director, choreographer, creating a character that's basically him.
Yeah.
And then having to put choreography on screen and say, yes, I am in which the scene is, I am a genius. And the airline, what I forget what the song is called, Fly With Us or Come Fly With Us, whatever it is one of the most, that's the inspiration by the Paula Abdul music video in the 80s.
Yes, yeah, the cold-hearted song.
Cold-hearted, is one of the scenes where you like go, oh, we are delivering great art and showing the chaotic, messy, unsure, difficult world that this guy creates to create his great art. you know?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And it also shows you what it's like to have, your obsession with creating this art cannibalize your life, like the obsession of it all. Right. And there are, as you said, there are a lot of musical biopics, but some of the ones that are the most interesting ones are the ones that have that tinge of tragedy because the artist is obsessed with making this, is obsessed with doing this thing and focused on it. There's, we just talked about Amadeus. There's elements of that when he's writing the Requiem. There is obsession of this that unsettles him just on so many levels, but he knows he's driven to do it. And so when he composes the, I mean, that scene alone with him and Salieri near the end. Yeah, one of the greatest scenes as he's like, da-da-da. And the, even the way he's speaking to him, this is what the film is leading to, is that moment where you actually see him create the Requiem and you're just like, oh my God, when you could have dismissed him as this laughing, giggling little child, to see him dial into the, it's almost like the light of God is on him as he's creating this stuff. And it's just kind of, it's amazing. Whereas with all that jazz, it feels much more desperate, much more like I need to this in order to exist. Right. And so it's much more visceral and primal and foundational in its approach, which I think is fantastic. And Roy Scheider is amazing in that film. Yeah. The guy who never gets enough credit, Steve, never gets enough credit, you know?
Well, and what's funny, all three of the examples, the Requiem scene in Amadeus, the watching everything that happens in Get Back, and so much that happens in All That Jazz, should teach people that are writing in to tell Christopher Nolan what to do, that this isn't about perfection. It's about process.
It's
all of these are processes. And one of the great things in the Requiem scene is that only, Salieri is a great composer and really understands music. Only he can understand and keep up, even struggle to keep up with what Amadeus is doing, is that it is that passion to make something great and figure it out and go through the process. You know, that's the that's the thing about art.
He's changed by the end of that process because now he understands the greatness of Mozart for real, you know, and all the things that he had made fun of him about, I think almost shames him because now he's really seen why he has this art that he has, you know, or the ability he has. Another one, because I know you want to say a little bit with biopics, but for right now, Ed Wood. I think this is a great, interesting approach to art. I wanted to make sure we could talk about all different approaches here. And, you know, we could have gone with some really great filmmaker making great a great movie, but I like the idea of the Ed Wood approach as well because he's the worst filmmaker ever. But watching him, well, I'm sure they're worse, but watching him and his love of movies, his belief in himself, his unyielding belief in himself, and how it elevates all these other people to go on this journey with him to make these movies with him. Because you know this as a director, Steve. One of the greatest gifts you can have is to convince people to be a part of your project and give time to your project because of your passion, your inspiration, your desire to do it. People connect with that. Artists connect with that. Creative people connect with that and will go on the journey to make your film or make your project, whatever it may be, because they believe in you. So watching that throughout the Ed Wood film, I think is amazing to see with this crazy collection of characters. The scene with him and D'Onofrio's Orson Welles at the diner is one of the most amazing scenes ever. The tender scenes with him and Bela Lugosi, right? But then you're watching him shoot those scenes on set for these films that you know are not going to be great, but he believes in them. He thinks they're amazing. And that makes you go, there is so many phenomenal, there's so many varied, various ways to determine art, what is art. And this, I have to sit back and relax and go, or sit back and say, this is art. Absolutely, whether it's great or not, it is art. Its very definition, you know?
Well, the thing about Ed Wood, and you and I know this because we've been around a lot of people making various kinds of art, and spoiler alert, a lot of it wasn't good. Yeah. And this is the thing. Yes. The people passionately going after their art, whether they're geniuses or Ed Wood, the passion is the same. The feeling of, I have to make this thing, and I am so excited. It, you know, at the very beginning of the conversation, you know, you had the Vin Diesel quote about, like, popular art versus, it's like, that's your art. I mean, you know, like, there's so many people that are into so many things that I am not into. But that doesn't mean there isn't great art. That doesn't mean there isn't great passion for it. That doesn't mean they're not excited. And, of course, the other thing is, with Amadeus, the talent and the passion line up.
Yes.
With Ed Wood, maybe they don't so much, you know, or Ed Wood has a talent for doing what he does.
But I think that's what's great about Ed Wood is that, like, he is not a Amadeus. He's not a Mozart. He's not even a Salieri. But when, as a filmmaker, he has a vision and he is doing his vision there in the film through those scenes. But also when things fall apart as a filmmaker, you have to troubleshoot. You have to find that money. You have to figure things out. You know this, Steve, yourself. You've had the experience. And so that's profiled so well in the movie. I like that it strips away this, like the Fablemans. I'm not a Fablemans person. Right. Ed Wood absolutely shows you, like, okay, this is what it's like to make this kind of guerrilla type filmmaking. And so it is profiling the creation of art and what it takes to create art. It's not Robert Downey Jr. in the dressing room creating Charlie Chaplin, the Tramp, rather. It's a lot more of improvisation, troubleshooting, and flying by the seat of your pants. And I think all of that is showcased in Ed Wood so well.
While we're in still discussing kind of biopics, I want to just lay out what I would call the general of the genre, which is basically the, you know, VH1 Behind the Music sort of thing, which is you're going to meet a young person who is incredibly passionate and talented, maybe from a difficult childhood in some way, maybe. And their drive is going to bring them success. And on the way to success, the flaws within their characters, their insecurities, the whatever leads them in a bad direction, which might involve drugs, it might involve any relationships, and then they're going to kind of come around. And that is, you brought up, you know, it's Ray, it's Walk the Line, it's Bohemian Rhapsody, it's Rocket Man, it's, you know, it's Dewey Cox, the Walk Hard, Cox card. Like that just whole, and the thing is, we eat them up. Like they're usually successful. Yeah. I've enjoyed everyone. Everyone, if they've cast it well and the music is good, that, you know, I'll go on that journey. And I think it is a very true story about a lot of people coming up in the world of art who get massive success, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. What's your next one?
Oh, well, then if I'm going to take it in an entirely different direction, maybe.
Please feel free.
Because the other thing is, there's lots of movies where it's not about the professional. It's about art in our world. And the first one that pops to my mind is Dead Poets Society.
Oh, yeah.
Dead Poets Society is all about, this is why it's important for poetry to be in your life.
Yeah.
Poetry is about dreams and romance and love and beauty and art and all the things that make life worth living. And, you know, there really is only one kid in that classroom who wants to pursue actually a profession in the arts. And spoiler alert, that's the kid that kills himself. So it's not about the profession. It's about, this is why art is good for us, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. That movie, I mean, it might be time. I don't think we've done that one. So it might be time to do it at some point in the next couple of years. It could be interesting to tackle that one because it's been so long since we did that. And of course, we love Robin Williams. But I do remember that being because it came out in 89. So I'm a teenager, late teens, watching that in the movie theater. And I'm a guy who's done acting in high school, who wants to become an actor, but doesn't have the guts to do it at the time. So I escape into the military, I escape into another university, and then eventually find my way back 9 years later to pursue it and try to make something of it. And I just remember sitting there watching that in the movie going, like, this is something that I can identify with, this is something I understand. And it profiles that artistry through that way. And you get inspired. These people, and how important it is to be inspired by people to create art, to find what you're supposed to be as an artist. And if we were a better society, we would encourage more people who want to become artists to be artists. Yes, it's not an easy life. It's a tough life. There's always that caveat, but you just never know if they'll find their path through it. And I think that film showcases how important art really is and how people in power want to shut voices down that seek to create art and seek to give you your voice and your freedom, which is what art really symbolizes, is freedom of expression. And so you see that there in that movie as well. You know, very powerful stuff for sure. Yeah. Well, if we stay with writing, one that a lot of people don't talk about, and I saw years ago with Adam Driver, called Patterson. I don't know if you've ever seen Patterson.
No.
Yes. Directed by Jim Jarmusch. Adam Driver plays this, like, essentially this bus driver who writes poetry in his notebook, and he writes some of the most beautiful poetry. And as you said, Steve, it's about the art. We have to see the art, and you see the poems that he writes here are just so moving and touching. And he's not a tortured artist. He's not someone who's enduring all kinds of pain. He's just creating it from observations of the world around him and putting it together and creating these poems. And I like that it was like a film that goes left when you expect it to go right, zig instead of zag, because we don't have the artist who is suffering or struggling or pained or anything. It's an artist who has this come to him, and he writes his stuff down. And it's a very simple, elegiac approach to the idea of art, and that you don't have, it can be real without having to suffer for it or be in pain over it. And that art has just as much value as the art that is struggled and obsessed over and fought for. And so I like that that was an element of Patterson, or an energy in Patterson, that I hadn't seen before in a film like that. So I thought that was really great.
I haven't seen it, but I'd like to, because I actually think that of all the arts, portraying the art of writing on mm-hmm. film is almost the most impossible, because it is just words. And so like, you don't have the beautiful symphony, you don't have the beautiful painting, you don't have the beautiful dance or something like that. And the process of writing is incredibly boring visually. And I cannot tell you, so most of the movies that when I was teaching film school, they really wanted to do movies about horrible, violent, terrible, suicide, rape, torture. Like, that's all my students. That's what they wanted to make all the time. But the other one that came up all the time was the person with writer's block, because that's what they all have. They all have writer's block. And so they're like, oh, I have this experience. And it's writer's block feels terrible. It is the worst. It is emotional. It's awful. But it is visually fucking boring. And so I'd always go like, well, how are you show? Because the process of writer's block is I'm just sitting here looking at a computer doing nothing. Or I wander into the kitchen and I look in the fridge, and then I kind of do something else. And like, it is literally nothing happened. And so trying to show, whereas the process of the Beatles getting together to figure out an album is super exciting. Yeah. Amadeus and Salieri trading over the Requiem or choreographing a dance thing. Those things are great. Yeah. Watching a person alone in a room trying to come up with good words is visually terrible. So like, it's super hard to do on film.
Which is why I think adaptation is one of the, that's also on my list.
Yes. One, yeah.
One of the great films about art, creating art. And as Steve was mentioning, writing, how do you make writer's block exciting? Well, you give your writer a twin, and then you have them go on this journey to try to solve their writer's block. You have Robert McKee or Brian Cox playing Robert McKee do a cameo here explaining the book story and what was going on there. So you make it interesting how they're going on this journey to solve this writer's block, and then what it leads to. And because you also juxtapose it with voiceover work being done there for the White Oleander story. So that all of that is I think adaptation is an incredible exploration of what it's like to be a real obsessed writer, and what it's like to be stuck and try to get over it, and the crazy things you try to do and go through to try to get past your writer's block. You know,
adaptation is, I mean, like, that is such a perfect example of a goddamn genius coming up with a way to create a feeling that is incredibly boring and making it amazingly exciting. Like, that's, I mean, that guy, it's Charlie, what's his name?
Charlie Kaufman. Yeah.
Charlie Kaufman.
Yep.
Oh my God. What an unusual genius he is. Trying to think what my next one should be.
Okay.
Oh, let's go in an entirely different direction.
Okay.
A movie that I think the more you think of it makes very little sense.
Okay.
And is one of the great, most joyous, lovely movies that I adore. And that is Singing in the Rain.
Oh yeah.
Singing in the Rain, great about one. The process of making movies. And it's just like, wait, what are they were doing a silent film that's like a period piece, but then they turn it into a musical. And then there's like this Broadway melody thing that looks nothing like the period piece. And like, wait, what's happening in this movie? And it doesn't matter, because the joy of Singing in the Rain is so much fun. And I do not, I mean, there are things in it, like how you deal with sound and how like cameras work and things like that, that are about the art of making film. But really, it's just an incredibly joyful musical.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, that is, I mean, people talk about films, oh, Hollywood loves itself, a love letter to Hollywood, all that kind of stuff. But there's a way to do that where it finds it, where you find the real magic of what it's like to work in the in that business and what it's like to create what you can create in that business. And they deal with, I mean, the using the advent of sound is such a brilliant prism to create that movie through, and all the things that happened around all of that. And still keep the drama and the tension of people losing their jobs to sound, but also seeing them explore this new opportunity and what they can do with it. It's really fantastic. And doing it all on the sound stages and whatever. But also, again, what you have to struggle through, which is sometimes studio politics, sometimes the ego of the diva star. And you have to navigate all of that sometimes in order to make the great art and bring in your girlfriend to voice over the songs for the diva because she wants to be seen good, and the contract issue. So the fact that they explored all of that within the film is a bit of realism amidst the musical, which sometimes gets lambasted for being fantastical, you know?
Yeah. What's your next?
Ooh, that's a good one. All right, let me see. That's a tough one to follow up with. What do I have here? Oh, okay. Shine, which is a film no one talks about anymore. I can't believe that it is 30 years old officially this year, which is insane to me. It's the film that announced Jeffrey Rush to everybody, basically. He won the Best Actor Oscar for this portrayal here. And the way, and to me, there's a lot of connections to Amadeus, not just because that he's playing Rachmaninoff's the Third, not just because it's, you know, classical music, and not just because he's a torture guy, but so much about what he's going through here throughout the process in this film of being a genius, but having, again, a domineering father like Amadeus did, who was trying to push him farther and farther, except he was a little bit more susceptible to the mental health breakdown that happens to him than maybe Amadeus is until later in his life. And so we see what the process of art can do to a young man if you use it to break him. And what can happen to him, and how he goes on this journey to find his way back to the art, to find his way to be able to play this art again. And it is incredible. And I cry every time I watch that movie. Jeffrey is amazing. Armin Mueller-Stahl is his dad. When they have that one scene when he returns later in the film, you're just wrecked. Oh God, is it Gene Stapleton? Who am I thinking of? Oh, I forget who plays the woman he falls in love with at the end, who's through the most of the movie, very famous British actress. I forget her name right now, but yeah, she's fantastic as the back and forth with him as he's finding his way back out of the morass to be able to play again and display his art again, which is phenomenal, you know?
Shine is a great choice. It's on my list too. It's such a good movie. I am really upset for you to tell me that it was 30 years ago. But the thing about that it shows, and you see this in a bunch of films, is genius, artistic talent can be a burden. It can be hard. It isn't an easy taskmaster. It isn't always easy to deal with. And particularly in the contrast between your passion and your talent and your eagerness to do the thing, and whether or not anyone's letting you do the thing, or what the perfection or the distance between the perfect art that you imagine that's in your head and what you're actually able to create, you know, because that's the Salieri thing too, of he can understand Mozart, but he can't get there. And in Shine, it's just that it's so funny because I think if we watched Whiplash and Shine back to back, you know, because there's like a lot of like, that's where Andrew and Whiplash goes.
Right.
If he doesn't succeed at the end of the movie, it's very possible that he ends up as that guy.
Great point. If he doesn't stop and turn back around and remove himself from his father's embrace and get back on that stage, go toe to toe with Fletcher, he may end up, as you said, very well, like the guy in Shine, you know.
Or if he goes back on that stage and it sucks.
Yes. And it sucks. Right. Exactly. By the way, the actress is Lynn Redgrave. I can't believe I forgot Lynn Redgrave, for God's sakes. But yeah. So much of that movie just kind of has hung with me since I saw it in 96, and I've never let it go. And I'm always mystified that that film isn't talked about more by people about how for its greatness and its genius and Jeffrey Rush's performance. So yeah,
so good. All right. So totally good. My next one, let's go back to the theater.
Okay.
Because my next one is All About Eve.
Oh yeah. Good one. Good one.
Joseph L. Mankiewicz. Again, I've been watching old stuff recently. So I watched this maybe 3 months ago or 4 months ago. Okay. I think Eve, who's played by Anne Baxter, deserves her place as one of the greatest villains in all of movie history. I think she should be put up with Darth Vader and
Hans
and Die Hard. Yeah, Eve is so, and the thing about it is the and what's interesting, this doesn't have to deliver on really seeing a great performance. It's all about the shenanigans backstage, but there's so much about the status and undercutting and the arrogance of the artist and bringing the fame to them and the fawning like nature of Eve when she comes, when she shows up towards Margot Channing. Like that's like, it's all about that stuff. And I think it perfectly captures many things that go on in the real world of actors and stars and theater and artists.
Yeah. I mean that, I think, didn't she win the best, did it win best picture? Or did she win best actor? I can't, I thought it won Oscars. All of
I'm,
Eddie, but
I'm
I wasn't
currently
sure.
On the Wikipedia page. Yes. Okay. It won best picture, won best director. Both Anne Baxter and Betty Davis were nominated for Best Actress and didn't win. And it won screenplay, supporting actor, a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the progression of the film, as you see her ingratiate herself and come into power more and more, there's a ruthlessness to it that you're like, oh my God. Like, it is really scary how ruthless she is. And you know, this is, again, and this is a great thing to bring this up, Steve. This is a great thing about old movies and people who are like, oh, I don't go back and watch old movies. Yet they want to celebrate the brave, groundbreaking plots of the current films that are already been, that have already been done back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, but they didn't go backwards in time to watch them. And they have a lack of knowledge of how ruthless some of these stories are back in the 40s and 50s and 60s with black and white movies. And this is another one of those that shows you that, you know, because you're right. She is absolutely villainous. And it's so unsettling the way she grows in power throughout the whole thing. I mean, if you can go toe-to-toe with Betty Davis, for God's sakes, you've done something for sure. And of course, Anne Baxter in The Ten Commandments as Nefertiti. So I love her as an actress. And so she's such a huge part of this. And seeing her embrace her power as it grows throughout the film is truly one of those like scary things, because a lot of us don't have that really just obsessive desire to succeed where everybody is just in the way in your mind. You know, you're almost in awe of that and in horror of it, for honestly. Yeah,
I think you bring up a really good point, and this is like part of the reason that there's so many movies about art and artists is the people making movies are artists, and so that's their world, you know, like, so that's part of the reason. But the other thing I think in a lot of these is it's similar to like a sports movie, which is it brings all of the human tensions into super sharp relief, because we have a ticking clock, we've got the performance. We have to work together. You have different personalities. You have different ambitions. You have genius that can be difficult. Like all of those things really create great pressure cookers for stories and exploring the human condition, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. 100%. Ooh, my turn again?
It is.
Okay. Let me see what else I've got on my list here that I want to talk about that inspires me. Oh, of course. Well, you just said the theater, right? So I got to put this up. Birdman. I mean, Birdman, come on. Like, I mean, this is one of the most recent movies. By the way, let me break your heart again. That was 12 years ago, which is insane. I thought it was last year. It's just crazy how much that film, if you're an artist, if you've been on the stage, how much that film kind of gets inside you as you're watching it. Yes, it's fantastical. Iñárritu does a lot of weird stuff with that movie, but you're focused on Michael Keaton's journey, what he's going through, what he's trying to do, trying to put this production all together, dealing with an Ed Norton type who's maybe an Ann Baxter type, trying to kind of undercut him and take the attention away from him, dealing with the relationship he's having with Andrew Riseborough. Is that happening? Is it not happening? Is she pregnant? Not pregnant? the situation with his daughter, Emma Stone. So all of that coming together to try to create, and as he's trying to create this comeback vehicle for himself, you know, and come to terms with whether he is an artist to be taken seriously or not because of his early success playing a superhero, which is very meta with the Batman stuff.
Yeah.
All of that that's explored here, I think, is fantastic because, Steve, you know this as well, and some of you listening and watching us know this as well. Sometimes creating great art, you have to navigate a fuck ton of chaos, and artists sometimes find their inspiration in the chaos, which is some of the most uncomfortable things to be around. But when you see the end result, it really is kind of a mind fuck because some people do live in the chaos and could create great art from the chaos, and they need the chaos from which to create the great art. And you see that, I think, in Birdman as well, which is a challenging thing for the audience.
Well, this was what was so interesting to me about finding sort of these themes and connective tissues, because that's all that jazz. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I'm not saying anyone should go out and watch this movie, but the New York stories, three films by Scorsese, Woody Allen, and Coppola, two of them, you know, you have a terrible Coppola movie. You have a completely phoned in Woody Allen movie that's mildly amusing. And then you have an amazing Martin Scorsese movie with Nick Nolte as a painter.
Right.
And that is exactly what he has to do. I have to create all sorts of emotions and chaos in my life in order to produce art. And frankly, I mean, Birdman does such a good job of, this is what making a movie is like. I'm telling you, man, it is, you are sprinting constantly, putting out fires constantly, chaos constantly, trying in the end to make something and get through and accomplish what you have to accomplish in your day and in your life. Yeah, Birdman is a great one.
And you're being driven because you want to prove you're a legitimate, serious artist. But what does that mean? Why do you need that? So that becomes like the conversation he has with the critic in the bar, I think is incredible to showcase the critic versus artist debate. And should you really need their approval for your legitimacy? So it's all of that, exactly what Vin Diesel was getting at, this idea of popular cinema not being seen as great art. And, you know, what he's navigating there in the conversation, she is pushing back as the intelligentsia, the critic, saying, no, it must reach this level in order to be considered legitimate art or serious art. And he is battling from the other side battling with the need for their approval, but also hating the need for their approval, which I think is what most artists fight with all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and certainly is real for a whole bunch of, how many actors are there who got known as this thing and have spent the rest of their career either going back and doing that thing again because they can do it, or trying to prove that they're not just that thing.
Yes.
You know, like that's 100%. So
yes.
My next one is a film that I love that I think has been entirely forgotten by history. I never hear anybody ever talking about this, and it is 1948. It is Howard Hawks's film, A Song is Born, starring Danny Kaye and Virginia Mayo. It is a screwball comedy. And what's crazy about the movie is that it's a remake of a earlier Howard Hawks film, which is not a musical, called Ball of Fire, that he then remade as a musical with Danny Kaye. A Song is Born is way better than Ball of Fire. And what's so great about it, it's the plot is this, and it's a goofy screwball comedy. The plot is that there is an intellectual music professor trying to write an encyclopedia of music with a whole bunch of classical musicians. They're held up in a house. And then Virginia Mayo, who is the gun moll of a mobster, hides out in the house and they have to protect her. And she brings in all these jazz musicians, including Benny Goodman, Tommy Dorsey, and Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
And these classical musicians have never heard jazz music. And so it's all of them playing music together through the whole thing. And the music is great. And it is so goofy and silly and totally fun. And I highly recommend it. So I would like it not to be forgotten by history because it's a really funny, goofy screwball comedy.
What's it called again?
It's called A Song is Born.
A Song is Born. I've never heard of this movie.
No one has. Well, actually, someone has. Someone has, because Vizanda 316 says it's amazing. And there are a bunch of people here who know this movie. It's a great movie. Yeah.
We know our audience.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, wow. So Billy Wilder wrote the script as well. Co-wrote the script. Oh, wow.
Okay. No, this is a good, I am confident you will like this movie. You know,
oh, I think if it's got Benny Goodman, Tommy Dorsey, Louis Armstrong, Lionel Hampton, I am 100% thinking, and Danny Kaye, obviously, and I love Virginia Mayo.
Yeah.
I guess I got to put this on my list. It's just like Steve. I've also been watching older film. I'm watching more older Westerns now, trying to catch up on some ones I've never seen that I barely heard of. But like, I need to start putting a little variety in and looking at some of these older movies as well, man. Because you're right. It feels like, doesn't it feel like we're losing touch with the older movies? And everyone's moving so fast towards this technology and towards the future. It's like, these movies still matter. They exist. The TCM Festival was just here, or just there in LA, which I was bummed to miss. And there were all kinds of movies that they were showing there that I'd never seen. And if I'd known about it, I would have like found a way to kind of go to that festival for those days to see those movies, because seeing them in the theater with like-minded individuals is the best way to appreciate those kinds of movies. The new movies, I don't really want to see in full theaters that much unless they're Marvel films. But the older films, I love to watch them for the first time with other people who are watching them as well. So that, because you got to get that feeling, that energy and excitement to see if you're going to like it or not, you know? So it's great. Yeah. I will go to the stage as well with Topsy Turvy, which is a film I mentioned earlier in our conversation. I love Topsy Turvy. Mike Leigh's film is a 3-hour exploration of Gilbert and Sullivan putting on the Mikado. And what that is all about. You've got Gilbert and Sullivan both navigating the fact that they've hit a wall because they've just essentially repeated themselves over and over and over again. Is it Gilbert or is it Sullivan who wants to break out? I think it's Gilbert who wants to break out and do his own thing. And Sullivan is like, no, we're fine doing everything exactly the way we should be doing it. And I think it's Gilbert who's the one that wants to go and it's Sullivan. Sullivan feels he's not growing as an artist. And Gilbert, which is played by Jim Broadbent, is refusing to change his methods because he's very stick in the mud throughout. And he's like, well, if it works, it works. Why are we changing it? Blah, blah, blah. So Gilbert gives a little bit so that Sullivan will feel like he can come back and create something new with the Mikado. And they fool themselves that they're creating something new. So by the end of the movie, when it's shown to them that they didn't, that's what leads to the separation of Gilbert and Sullivan. So it's a fascinating exploration. But throughout the 3-hour movies, you're also seeing how they put this play together, how they bring in Japanese women to teach these British actresses how to play these Japanese women. You're seeing the actors debate their salaries over lunch, and you're seeing a team of actors rally around an actor who has been fired because they're going to cut the role from the play, and how they fight back against that. So it is an interesting the costuming stuff that happens, the battle with the costumers. There's so much that is profiled in this film about making a play, making great art, that I think is a must watch for anybody who has any connection to the theater. Yes, it's a 3-hour film, but trust me, if it hooks you, you're going to love it. It's really great, a great profile in art on film, you know?
Well, I'm glad you've said that, because you will be disappointed in me. I have never seen Topsy Turvy. I meant to. I know that I would love it. So I will make it in the next week or two. I will watch Topsy Turvy. I've always meant to watch it. But it makes me think of another movie, because which, even though I haven't seen Topsy Turvy, which I thought was really good, which was last year's Blue Moon with Ethan Hawke.
I thought it was
about a musical theater partnership,
right?
And I think it's a really, really good version of seeing the sad artist in a bar, desperate, who's charming and funny and interesting and desperate, you know. I've been that person. I related, you know. We said very much that, you know, like, part of it, you know, when you see great artists, you see yourself in them. Well, I saw myself in that character, not in the most complimentary way sometimes, but like, I think it's a really good movie.
Yeah. Is it Rodgers and Hart? Is that who it is?
That
it's profiling, right? Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. And it's not a bottle movie, like they say, a bottle episode, but it does feel that way, right? It's all in the bar.
Yeah.
Yeah. And having the conversations and exploring all of this stuff and what comes up for him as he's doing all this. And it's an interesting collection of actors with Margaret Qualley and Bobby Cannavale and Andrew Scott. This is a good mixture of different voices, different energies in it as Ethan Hawke has taken center stage, you know? And, you know, I don't know how you feel about him, man, but he has really become a great actor. Like, I always thought Ethan was good, of course, right in, as we mentioned, Dead Poets Society, but like Reality Bites, these other films. But at times, for me, he radiated a bit of pretentiousness about himself, and it didn't make me gravitate to his work. But I think since Training Day, he's really kind of become stronger and stronger with interesting efforts. First Reformed was one recently a few years ago. He got nominated for, and then Blue Moon. So like, he's becoming this really strong artist, and finding even more power as he gets older as an actor as well. And seeing him and the back and forth that they have in this film, and what they, you know, the disappointments throughout this thing is really, as you said, Steve, it's an unsettling thing when you look at it, and you've pursued art yourself and not found the full-on success that you were hoping for and what that leads to. And then the pressures of it, if you haven't found a little bit of success, which Rodgers and Hart did, you know, so
And then the success leaves without you. You know, it takes on that Oscar Hammerstein guy, and it's just, you know, it was let's just say I feel it. Like, you and I have both known people occasionally that went farther than we did, and there's always sort of a, oh, okay, that could be a little bit rough. I'm trying to figure out what my next one is.
I don't mind it. As long as they don't change who they are. And I have seen people I know become more successful, and all of a sudden they become different people, and they're much more, they become Hollywoody. And when they become Hollywoody, that's pretty much the end of my desire to connect with them as strongly as I did before, because there's a bit of a facade that happens that are superficiality.
100%.
Yeah.
And there's the thing, like, there's no question that Rodgers is one of the great geniuses of the musical theater. That's 100% true. You and I, and I'm not naming any names, don't even know if we agree on them. There are sometimes people where they had lots of success and we did not feel that they deserved it on some level, you know, like, what? Like that guy? Really? That's who? Okay. Wow. All right.
But that's the Salieri. That's the Salieri in all of us. Yeah. You're like, what? This person?
Yeah. Well, and this is the thing, is that with Salieri, it's Mozart. I mean, Salieri knows why it's Mozart. Right, if you did an Amadeus, except it was just as obnoxious a personality as Amadeus, but not actually that talented, you know, because we've seen that many, many, many times. I've been debating about my next one forever. Okay. And I want to go back to this category, because we haven't been there in a while, of the non-professional, of the just saying that art is important in your life. And the movie I'm picking is Dirty Dancing. There's no question that she's ever going to be a professional dancer. That is not what the movie is about. The movie isn't even about doing a professional performance. Like, we hope that we get the lift. Like, that's it. Like, can we accomplish it? But what it really is using art and dance as a metaphor for coming of age, as a metaphor of maturing, as a metaphor for exploring things across the tracks, doing things that are more dangerous, not being put in the corner. Nobody puts baby in the corner. Like, I think that kind of a movie, because the thing is most of us are not going to be Mozart. Most of us are not going to be Ray Charles or any of these other great artists. But art can live in your life in a way that is transformative and important and experiential. And I think Dirty Dancing is a perfect example of that.
That's a great point you bring up, Steve, because the dancing itself symbolizes something to her family and her father and the current state of existence that they're in at that time, right? But for her, it represents, as I've said before, art is freedom. Art is rebellion. Art is where you don't want to, or can inspire you to not just accept your state or your condition in life, but to want more, to explore more, to let that inner voice of yours come out. And I think you're born with it. I think you're born with a desire for art, whether it's immediate or latent. I think you're born with it. Not everyone has it, just like not everyone has mental health issues. I think some people are born with it and some people aren't. And some people develop it later. That's certainly possible. But there are people who go through life who never have one mental health issue at all. And there are people who go through life who don't really feel the proclivity or desire to go create art. And that's the truth. And so seeing it in the version, seeing it in the small film like Dirty Dancing, seeing what she sees art symbolize for her and why she desires to push against all these norms and all these expectations, because she wants to use art to essentially express her voice, express her independence, her freedom, her power. And it's fantastic to watch that through the film, dude. Absolutely agree with you. What a great choice. I didn't even think about it for this list, but that's such a smart choice when you look at it, for sure.
All right.
We got to go. We haven't done a comedy. We got to go to this, a Spinal Tap. Come on. I mean, that is a 100%. Film we covered on the show. We had such a great time talking about that film. Of course, we profiled Rob Reiner recently, did a season of Rob Reiner in his film. So the exploration of art in that film is just it's deceptive, because you're so caught up in all the funny moments and the weird moments and the characters and all that stuff. But they are legitimately a band who thinks that they are creating great music and want to create great music and driven to create great music. And they're dealing with all the egos and the issues that they have within the band and outside the band as they try to create that music. But they are driven by this Northern Star. No matter how many drummers die, no matter how much Stonehenge doesn't come in, it doesn't come life-size, like no matter how much that happens to them, they are still determined to create the music. And it's that drive that I think is so essential to making that film a success, beyond the comedy, you know?
I just want to clarify, are you saying that that Big Bottom, Stonehenge, and Sex Train are not great music?
I know, I'm saying, you know, well, I mean, I don't know if it's great music. I'm just saying they think it's great music, and I love that they're driven to create this kind of stuff, because they're kind of like the forgotten hair band of the hair band time, you know?
And what's so great about it, and I've heard many rock musicians talk about this, is it might be a ridiculous comedy, but it is accurate. That is what it is. And most of the time, you're actually not working with Mozart. Most of the time, you are like scrambling to make a thing, and it is just as ridiculous and stupid. And frequently, you're listening to people make as dumb requests as Nigel does. You know, like, it is just like that is the reality. I mean, I think like what makes, well, and this is the thing, is like what part of what makes Spinal Tap so great is that they get it right. I mean, that's what makes it so darn funny.
Yeah, agree 100%. All right, let's do one more each, Steve, and then we'll get to the questions and wrap up our conversation. We've been going on for an hour and 15 minutes now. So what's your next one? Maybe final one, or do you want to do a final couple? What do you think?
Why don't we do what I want to just mention a thing, which is we don't have to spend a lot of time on, but there have actually been four versions of A Star Is Born.
Oh, yeah.
So in the first version, it's two actors. In the second version, it's two musical theater actors. And then both the Barbra Streisand, Kris Kristofferson, and the Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper, are country musicians and pop singer. But all of them, I think all four are good movies in different ways. And all four of them are exploring becoming a great artist, artistic jealousy, the moment that you're on the upswing, the moment that you're on the downswing. I think all four of them really are about, in some way, the journey of an artist.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, I mean, and what it can lead to. One is on the come up and wants to embrace the art form and is humbled by the fact that they could actually achieve the success that they achieve. And the other one is hit the ceiling and doesn't see that there's more, doesn't see that they can create more art or can find or can grab that success that they had before. And that's another element of art that I think is you're highlighting here, Steve, as well, is like how you deal with it when you've hit like the best you're ever going to do. We love to talk about one hit wonders, but how many of us really explore the biography of these people who kept trying to make albums and kept trying to capture that success again and never found it again? And yes, they, you know, things have changed now. People who are one hit wonders come back in 30 years and they're doing cruises and all this kind of stuff. They're performing, they're making money, but you're known for that song. What is that life like where you've hit the limits of your success? You know what it's like to have your name chanted in an auditorium and then less people show up, right? We just had, right now they're calling it the blue dot effect, is what, something like that, blue dot theory, whatever it is. And what it essentially implies is that when an artist starts to cancel their tours and their shows, it's because when they look at the tickets sold, they see way more blue dots than not. And that's how, that's a thing that's becoming a term now to describe what happens when artists cancel their tours or their shows, which is Pussycat Dolls just did that. Kiefer Sutherland just did that recently. So you're seeing that less and less people are even coming out to see the art that that they were before. So how does that feel for you? What is that journey like? And I think that gets explored through the Bradley Cooper and Kris Kristofferson characters so well in those two versions. And James Mason, I think a little more dramatically in James Mason's case, because it's also about him being older than her. So there's another element of that. I don't think that's as much of an element with Kris Kristofferson or Cooper. It's more about having lost the stardom they once had, you know? And so, but what it leads to in Cooper is that depiction is, I think, the most
brutal,
unsettling. Yeah, brutal.
Yeah, it's really brutal. Well, it's funny. And again, this is why I keep seeing all these themes that go back and forth, because the moment of your past, you know, like we have the movies that are about the coming up, like you are arriving, you are the young, hungry one. And then we have the movies about the, oh, you're past your peak. And that's Blue Moon. That's that's all the Stars Born movies. And there was another one we just talked about too. Oh, Birdman. Birdman is that too. It's like you had all the people cheering for you, and now all those people have gone away. And you and this is the thing. And I think there's such a, because stardom and massive success is so corrupting and so addictive. You know, it's so funny there, because we're as we mentioned, we're prepping Devil Wears Prada. And there's a moment in it where Meryl Streep's character, Miranda Priestley, says, well, everybody wants this life. And I look at her life and I go, no, I really don't. And maybe I thought I did when I was young. And those stars coming up are going like, I just want the brass ring. I just want to get that. And there's only maybe four people in movie history that have held on to the brass ring for more than a decade. You know, Tom Cruise being one. But most people, it's only going to be a second. And then you're going to go back to being like, hopefully, a working actor. And so like this idea of what you should, you, all they're preparing for, all their work is to get the brass ring, is to have that moment. And then that moment is gone. That's brutal.
I mean, look no farther than Nicole Kidman. Nicole Kidman was at the top of the game for a few years there in the 90s and 2000s. Now, you know, she's popping up and doing ensemble work or spot work or leading TV series on Prime Video. Nicole Kidman. And so that's the thing, is like, how do you navigate it when you're no longer the flavor of the month or the week? And the rarity, as you said, is Tom Cruise. Directors wise, Steven Spielberg or Scorsese. Those are the rarities that have multiple decades of film, or Billy Wilder, multiple decades of staying around and being able to reinvent themselves and capture the energy of the time and do something that people want to come see. So you're absolutely right. It's a tough situation for sure. Yeah. Well, maybe that's a good place to wrap it up. Let's wrap it up.
I do have one more.
Okay.
I have one more that's very important. Okay. But for two particular reasons.
Very important. All right. Go ahead.
Yeah. Extremely, the most important movie I mentioned today.
Yes.
Is The Assistants, written and directed by Steve Morris, a film about making movies. And there is actually another reason why I bring it up. I rarely plug my own work. It's probably
rarely.
I've mentioned.
You talk about The Assistants all the time. What do you mean you rarely plug your own?
I don't think I've plugged The Assistants in a couple of years on The Cinephiles. You go back and check.
You mentioned The Assistants a lot.
I might mention it.
Well, that's essentially plugging it.
Because now I am actually plugging it, because it is for the first time ever available for free on Tubi.
The Assistants
is now on Tubi. So anyone who hasn't seen it, it's my film starring Joe Mantegna, Jane Seymour, and Stacey Keach in a Hollywood caper movie about trying to get a movie made. So it fits the category, and it just became 100% available a few weeks ago on Tubi, and so I did need to plug it.
Wait, do I have the thing up? I don't know if I have the thing up. Yes, absolutely. Totally plug it. Tubi is great. You guys should download Tubi. That's a great app. There's so many great films on Tubi, and now you can add The Assistants to the list of films that are on Tubi for sure. I think that's great. That's absolutely great. So there you go. And that's a film that Steve's 100% right. Profiles what it's like making a film and through his own experience. So it's almost meta. Would you say that it's almost meta? because you were making, because of the stuff you went through to make your film about a film that's making a film. Yeah.
I don't think there's anything I would say is meta in the movie, but my experience of making it is 100% meta. Like me having to manipulate and, you know, run around and scramble and losing locations and losing actors and then having to make things happen all the time. 100% meta.
Well, there you go. Well, as I mentioned, Steve has mentioned The Assistants many times. Some of you maybe didn't have access to it. So now you can watch it on Tubi. That's a great plug, brother, of course. All right. Well, let's get to some of these questions as we're getting close to the hour and a half mark where we wrap up usually our live show. So Carlton Rudder says, London calling. What's up, Carlton? Which films that pass the test of time best capture the emotional grind, inspiration, and chaotic beauty of the artistic process?
Ooh. I mean, a bunch of the ones that we've mentioned, All That Jazz, certainly.
Yeah.
The Requiem moment in Amadeus, 100%. There's so many of them, and I'm gonna look at my list because I feel like things that we haven't mentioned, like Almost Famous is one that certainly captures that.
Would throw 8.5, and we didn't even mention, which is probably the top film to talk about when it comes about to art and what a director goes through on his journey when he's having essentially not writer's block, creative block overall, and the madness of it all that he experiences, the both fantastical and realistic, as he navigates this frustrating process of art that doesn't necessarily lead to a great film. And so I think 8.5 is the one that we haven't mentioned that really is a film that has stood the test of time, and many current, recent, and older filmmakers have spoken about how much 8.5 speaks their language and inspires them and is a window into what the process is like for a director. You know, I don't know if you've, what your thoughts on 8.5, Steve. So, but
8.5 is a weird, it's so funny. I watched it. I probably haven't seen it since film school. So that's 25 years. And I remember watching it in film school going, I don't know if I get this mood. Like I didn't vibe with it well, and maybe I should revisit because I haven't seen a lot. I mean, all sorts of fascinating things, visually interesting, but I go like, okay, how do I feel about it? I don't really know. Right.
I know one of our good friends, Elena, is a massive fan of 8.5. And I wonder if we would ever be able to convince her to be a guest on our show if we ever tackle that movie. Darren says, just want to send some support for my favorite show. Thank you, Darren.
Thank you so much, Darren.
Much love to you. Doug, we got a Steve specific question from Doug. Oh. Hi, Steve. For you, how much harder or easier do you think it would be to direct yourself in your own movie? I'm so amazed how Eastwood is able to do it. Well, not just Eastwood, Brana, so many. Barbara Streisand's done it. Yeah,
Orson Welles.
Orson Welles, yes, of course. Citizen Kane.
I'm not a great actor. In my opinion, I'm an okay actor. I'm capable of acting. So like, and I did direct myself. I was in speaking of The Assistants, I'm in The Assistants. I have two lines, maybe one line. And fortunately I had Karen, my ex, off camera directing me because my first take was shitty. Not only was my first take shitty, but I actually did the wrong beat work. I knew what I wrote the line and I knew what I wanted that character to do. And then I ended up, when they said action, doing something else. And Karen walked up to me and said, you know, this really should be about that. And I'm like, of course it should be about that. That's what I meant to do. So I don't think I would be that good about directing myself, except, I mean, that's what, you know, when I'm editing and we're doing the podcast together, that's, you know, it's like, I don't have a problem directing my voice. I would say, because I, like I said, as an instrument for a director to work with, I don't think as an actor, I am that great an instrument. I can do some stuff. I can act, but it's not, you know, so like my issues with me directing myself are not my issues with me as a director. My issues with me would be me as an actor who I don't think he's okay. He's not great, you know?
I hear you. I also think I'm only okay. So I agree with you. I think
you're at a much higher level than I am. I think.
I don't know. It's been a while. I think it would be interesting to see. Oh, well, I hate watching myself on. Listen, I know Doug didn't ask me the question, but like seeing myself on screen was the end of me wanting to do it. So I think it would be an interesting thing to tackle directing myself in something. I think what you have to have, as you mentioned, Steve, so well with Karen, you have to have someone you trust who's on set, who essentially watches your performance and gives you the outside perspective of what if it's working or not. And it's an essential person to have on set for sure. Vizwana says, please do both All About Eve and Sunset Boulevard. Oh, I would love to do Sunset Boulevard. And I suppose All About Eve as well. Sure.
Sure. I haven't seen Sunset Boulevard in a while. My memory is I like All About Eve more. But yes, it's like if the cinephiles can go on forever, yes, I would love to do both those films.
Yeah, if. Verse 2304, the cinephiles live on YouTube. I love your podcast and I'm so happy to see you both. 1987's Throw Mama from the Train is my favorite film about writer's block and the power of perspective. Can I tell you something? I've never seen that movie. Steve, have you seen this movie? Tell me about it.
Not only have I seen it, it has the greatest line about writer's block I have ever seen in any movie ever, which is that Billy Crystal and Danny DeVito. Billy Crystal is a writer who's a writing teacher and he has writer's block. Mm. And his girlfriend wants to have sex with him. And he says, I can't. She's like, what do you mean? He says, I have writer's block. And she says, everywhere? That sums up so much about how writer's block feels. Because, yeah, everywhere. That is what writer's block feels like. And what's so there's so much good stuff about writing. I mean, like there's that, like, because Danny DeVito is writing a story and it's like a guy with a hat kills the other guy with the hat. That's the writing in the story. And he as a writing teacher is trying to help people to write. And this one guy is writing erotic fiction about the Laker girls, I think. That's a coffee table book. And there's like someone on a submarine. I could so remember that. I haven't seen this movie in 25 years. And I can remember this writing class. The woman I'm talking about the submarine goes, her writing is like, the man picked up the thing and spoke into the thing to the other guy who was running the other thing, because she knows nothing about submarines or anything that goes on, which is, this is what teaching writing is like. So 100% agree with this point. Great movie about writer's block.
Wow. Vulcan says, I wish I had Tubi here. Tubi's an app. Isn't Tubi available everywhere? Maybe it's not available in certain
No, I'm sure countries. It isn't because the rights for movies are only sold regionally. So all these, that's why your Netflix account in Europe doesn't have access to the same movies as the US or China or anywhere else, because it's all about the rights to the films.
Good point. Darren Wright says, will we ever get a Hunter S. Thompson biopic? Ooh, I mean.
There's Fear and Loathing.
I was going to say that's probably as close as we get, right?
He is a weird dude. Here's my very quick story. Fear and Loathing. First time I went to see it, crowded theater. I was a bit high. Absolutely hilarious. The theater was just going nuts for this movie. Then I watched it a second time with someone who was not interested in drugs, not high, just me and this other person when I worked on the DVD. Right. And it was, I'm sure you've had this, where you watch a movie with a different group of people and the movie is totally different.
Oh, yeah.
Then that movie was depressing and sad and just kind of disgusting. Yeah. Hunter is one of the strangest men. Brilliant writer. Crazy, bizarre. Yes. I think it would be an incredible biopic. I don't know what story you tell. It's huge, the crazy shit he's done.
Yeah. Agreed. Steve, why don't you answer this film while I use the restroom real quick, because we've hit the limit where I have to use the restroom. This is from KJ7457. He says, what is your favorite Woody Allen film about artistry? You can make an argument that all his films are about art.
It's a great point. I think like Bullets Over Broadway is the one that comes to mind first, because it's a central question of what is more important, the artist or the art. You know, it opens up with that scene, which I think Rob Reiner is in, where they're debating whether, you know, there's a burning building and you have the last folio of Shakespeare or a person, which do you save out of the burning building? And really the movie's all about exploring that. But I 100% agree. I mean, Purple Rose of Cairo in its way is about art. Broadway Danny Rose in his way is about art. Like there, and art and artists run throughout their books. So there's Midnight in Paris where it's about writers. There's there's a whole bunch where it really focuses on that. I think that's and this is the thing, which we just did recently, Annie Hall. It's not I would say, obviously, it's the main character is a stand-up comedian, and so it's about art in that sense, and we see some of the stand-up comedy. But because so much of that movie is bookended by these jokes and the importance of humor, and the way of looking at the world is the entire movie. So I think that is a perfect example of how art informs. And, you know, he's in the art world. There's so much about what he does that's in the art world. And I see we got another question here from Justin Toner, who says, "Hi guys, I really enjoyed this discussion. Lots of great examples given tonight." Awesome. Thank you so much, Justin. And I can hear the sounds of the outlaw. There he is. All right. Welcome back.
Thank you, man. Sorry, I'm an old man. I have to drink a lot of stuff, and I have to use the restroom sometimes. 90 minutes is pretty much my limit nowadays. I agree with you. I think Bullets Over Broadway is my favorite. I agree 100%. Although I do think, although it was not well received, the one where he's blind trying to direct the movie, Hollywood something, I can't remember what it's called.
Deconstructing Harry?
Is that what it is? Oh, which one is it? The one?
Oh, no. That's not it. That's there
it's Hollywood is... something. I can't remember what it's called.
But, oh, I haven't seen it. Yes. Is that with, well, with you'll figure it out.
Tay Leone is his, is like his assistant who is like his former girlfriend who is like helping him, even though he's blind. God, I can't remember the name of it. Did he write it even? Hollywood Ending. There it is. Hollywood it's Ending. Not a great film, right? But I think having him be blind as a director making a movie, there's an incredible commentary being made about what it's like to be a director, what you have to do. Right. And when you remove your eyes, and they're constantly trying to hide that he's blind. I think it's a great exploration of making movies. And yes, thank you, Justin, for a very cool comment there as well.
I thought of Deconstructing Henry or Harry, whichever one it is, because there's the Robin Williams subplot is they're on a movie set and you see everything out of focus. So that's why I thought about that one.
I think that's great as well. Look, not all of his movies are great, clearly, but there are always at least something funny or a memorable scene in every one of his movies, whether they're good or not, for sure. All right. Well, there you go. Let's wrap it up there, Steve. We've gone on for 90 minutes. Thank you all so much for hanging out with us. As Steve said at the beginning of this conversation, this could be a 10-part, 12-part conversation, 12-part series about art in movies. We could have gone a million different directions, but this is the directions we chose to go in for this particular conversation. But we'd love to hear what you all think about some of the movies we brought up. We'd love to hear what you all think about, what you all suggest some movies that affect you, that you like better about the process of art, creating art, the exploration of all of that, and artists as well. Let us know in the comment section below, or DM us or tweet at us as well, wherever you, how you follow us on social media, or wherever you listen to us. And we hope you enjoyed the discussion. We hope we inspired you to look at some films. Certainly Steve inspired me to look at a couple films that I've never seen before, so I will have to take a look at that. And Steve, what do we have to tell these wonderful people? And anything else you want to say to wrap up our conversation, please?
Well, I have to put Topsy Turvy in my queue. That's what I got out of this. And also, what was the Adrian? What was the writer one that you said? I think it started with a P. Anyway, doesn't matter.
With who? Okay. Oh, Patterson. Yes, with Adam Driver. Yes.
Yeah, Adam Driver. That's the one. So I definitely add that. And if you want to support the show, you can do it at patreon.com/thecinephiles. If you haven't liked and subscribed on our YouTube channel, we would love to have you do that, or subscribe to the podcast feed on any of your podcast places. And you can leave reviews. You can leave comments on Spotify, here on YouTube. That's all fantastic. And if you want to reach me, it's SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. And like I said, Devil Wears Prada is coming next.
Absolutely. You can follow me at The Roke Says on all my social media as well. Please remember to subscribe to our channel here if you haven't subscribed yet, but also you can subscribe to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/JohnRokeSays, where I do all kinds of things, talking about film and entertainment. Got the Geek Buddies Hot Mic, Spill the Tequila show, my reviews, my reactions to Jedi Way, but also crazy stuff like watching the Ronda Rousey-Gina Carano fight, which I did a live watch along of last night on my channel. So those are things you get on my channel. So please subscribe if you feel like it. Thank you all so much. We love you madly, and we'll talk to you next time with another brand new episode here of the Cinephiles Live. Take care until then. Peace, everybody.